Welcome to the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Welcome back, everybody. This podcast is an encounter recorded with Dr. Catherine Bradley. Dr. Bradley is a clinical psychologist and an expert in ARFID. And what's that when it's at home? That is avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, ARFID, and that's what we're going to be calling it from here on in, because the other version is certainly a mouthful. She is, I said, a clinical psychologist. Her undergraduate work was done at Oxford Brookes University, and her doctorate in clinical psychology taken at the University of Leicester. She now works, where do you now work? In not North Warwickshire, that's where you're from, but instead in Nottingham.
Well, I live in Nottingham. I work for Derbyshire Children's Hospital.
Oh, well, I stand corrected. I'm afraid that British geography will never really be one of my strong points. In any event, Dr. Bradley works in ARFID, and that's an important subset of pediatric gastroenterology, hepatology, and nutrition. But that's not all that... That's not the only credential that she brings to the table. There's also lived experience. She is the mother of a child with total colonic aganglionosis. And to draw on that experience in counseling and treatment of children who, unlike most of us, cannot eat and drink unthinkingly, and of their families, well, that's very important. In this podcast, she addresses for us these three questions. What are the key signs that distinguish ARFID from typical, quote, picky eating, close quote, or other eating disorders? How does ARFID affect a child's physical and mental health? What are the long-term consequences if children and families go without support? What evidence-based approaches can be used to support a child and a family with ARFID? And which professionals should be involved? The note that accompanies this podcast, and please call it up, take a look, includes references to two articles that are gateways into resources that can be consulted as caregivers encounter ARFID. Dr. Bradley, may I call you Catherine?
Please do, yes.
Welcome.
Thank you.
ARFID. Do you know... There didn't used to be an ARFID, at least not when I went through medical school. Of course, that was back in the Jurassic, so it's not to be, I'm not surprised that progress has been made. But define ARFID for us, please.
So ARFID stands for Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder. These children have always been around, so it's previously been called things like extreme picky eating, or you might see in the children who we consider to be failure to thrive or faltering growth. A lot of these children have difficulties with food and eating that are based more on fear or sensitivities to texture or sensory properties of food, or they're worried what's going to happen if they eat that food. And some children who just don't appear interested in eating at all. It's a chore to them. It's not something that brings them joy. So in 2013, psychologists, doctors, dietitians, they got together and said, we need one term that describes all of these children. And they came up with the diagnosis ARFID, which is now in the ICD and the DSM.
I'm going to call on a conversation that I had recently with someone who is interested in the coincidence or the interaction between obesity and neurodevelopmental disorders, in which, for what reason ever, eating is disordered, and it has a connection with autism, with abnormal sensory processing. Your patients, or patients with ARFID, don't all fit into that box. They fall short of that somehow. They're not being tagged as on the autistic spectrum.
We do know that There are varying estimates in the ARFID population of how many of these children are neurodivergent, but some estimates that say maybe up to half of the children with ARFID are autistic. And it's important to consider that not every child with ARFID will be underweight. That's typically the image we think of. When we think of a child with ARFID, we think of a child that's very undernourished. But they can actually be an average weight, or they could even be an above average weight. If their food restriction means that the only food that they feel comfortable with is very calorie dense, they could be eating maybe 3 takeaway meals a day, which would lead them to overnutrition, but we could still consider that ARFID if it's having a severe clinical impact on their health.
Well, then let's get back to the question that I hope you'll address for us all. What are the key signs that distinguish ARFID from typical picky eating or other eating disorders?
Every child will go through a natural fussy eating stage, and this starts when they're about 1.5. And it's a great inbuilt safety function for humans.
What do you mean safety function for humans?
It's an evolutionary advantage. If you've got a child who has just started walking around, exploring new objects, picking things up, putting them in their mouth, you do want them to be very hesitant about that, to spit things out and not swallow things that are going to be harmful for them. So we think this is why all humans go through this stage. But most children have grown out of that. At the very latest, by the age of 6, it's often much earlier, at around 3 or 4, they start to accept new foods again and to be less fussy. You see sort of less throwing food away. But by age 6, most children have grown out of this natural fussy eating stage. The difference with ARFID is that it's very, very extreme, or you're seeing quite a severe clinical impact. So you would see children where their growth is affected. We see some children not growing taller, as well as being under or overnourished, as I mentioned before. But also they may have nutritional deficiencies too. We know that they have problems with bone density or calcium deficiency. If they also have a diagnosis of autism, there have been cases that have become sadly very extreme. They may even have vision loss due to vitamin deficiencies, or sadly, we have had some case studies of children dying because they just felt so unable to eat.
Unimaginable, but it happens. Yeah. How do your patients come to your attention? How are they referred to you?
I get most of my referrals from pediatricians. A lot of them are gastroenterologists. The children I work with specifically would usually have a medical condition as well. So I see lots of children who might have a history of something like tube feeding or reflux or inflammatory bowel conditions, where eating at some point in their developmental history has been very uncomfortable, or there's been a lot of pain. So they would usually be referred to me for some help because they're struggling to eat and their traditional advice is just not working.
Well, what other professionals do you call in to work with you and these families and children in order to obtain an optimal result?
It's really important that we have multidisciplinary care for these children. So they must see a doctor to rule out any physical cause for their not eating. Unfortunately, we have heard case studies in the past where children have been treated as if they have ARFID, and then it's been discovered that they have something like a gastroenterological cancer. So we must have a doctor to rule out any physical problems. A dietitian is essential too, to help with the assessment, monitor their weight and their growth. A lot of these children might need something like oral nutritional supplements as well. If there aren't many foods that they feel able to tolerate, they need something just to keep them healthy and keep them growing. In some cases, tube feeding. And finally, we really must have someone to address the psychological impact of the condition. These children can find it really hard to access their usual social spaces. Something like a children's birthday party could actually end up being very stressful. You have this big shared meal, there's lots of noise and busyness going on, and they're finding that they're just not able to join in. Or they might find difficulties eating at school. There could be impact on stress with the family. That can all be really difficult. So we need someone who can do some psychological support with them, and also some of the more formalized therapies as well that can help.
How do you approach these children, families, this entire rather complex situation?
So in Espigan, we are looking at a position paper at the moment for how to work best with these children from a multidisciplinary perspective. In psychology, we do have some evidence base for manualized therapies such as cognitive behavioral therapy. Those are mostly for older children, so around secondary school age. We would expect children to have developed the cognitive ability to reflect on their experience, think about what thoughts are driving their behavior. But younger than that, we have to draw on the older evidence base from before we had the ARFID label and look at the more behavioral style, family-led parent interventions.
Anecdotes. Give some examples.
So I'm working with a child at the moment who is tube fed after she became very constipated and some medication was added to her food and drink, and she stopped eating and drinking altogether. She had to go into hospital and have a nasogastric tube placed, and she just lost all interest in food completely. So I'm working with her parents. We've introduced a teddy bear who has a nasogastric tube taped to its face, just like her, and written a storybook for her about this teddy learning to eat. And it's her job, with the support of her mother, to help teach the teddy to eat. And of course, by extension, she learns to eat as well. And most of this work will happen at home. So I will go and visit and say, what's Teddy eaten this week? Show me his diary. What have you been doing? And I demonstrate the techniques to the mother. So I will show how we do it very gradually. We pick a food that the child thinks that she could manage, and she may at first just pick it up and touch it, or then she may sniff it or lick it or just put it near her mouth, and she always has the option to spit it out. And this is very play-based. It's very discovery-based. It's not about put the food in your mouth and swallow it for nutrition. It's playful.
That sounds as if... Well, it's nothing if not labor intense, I must say.
Yeah, it does take a lot of work, but it's a lot of fun as well. It's the kind of thing that keeps you going to work every day. Seeing a child who is able to take a bite of food and actually feeling proud of themselves or enjoying that food is such rewarding work.
But are there problems associated with these approaches?
There definitely are. So historically, work with individuals who are neurodivergent in particular has been very behavioral. And when these children have grown into adults, they have told us that they can find some of these practices very aversive if we're not incredibly careful about respecting their autonomy and their choice. So some older practices like escape extinction, which is...
I don't know what that is.
So it's basically where you would hold a bite of food in front of a child and not let them leave until they've swallowed it. And they might do it in the session, but as you can imagine, that can be incredibly stressful. And they're only doing it to please the caregiver or to escape the situation. Mm-hmm. And the stress hormones that are released in the body, they have all sorts of effect on your appetite. They make you feel sick. They give you dry mouth. So a stressed body is not a hungry body. So we don't want to do that from an ethical perspective either. So we have to be very, very careful that we work with these children to help empower them to make their own choices. So I might work with a child on selecting which foods they would like to try and then putting them in order from what would feel most easy to try to the most difficult. And we work up very, very gradually. And they're in control. and I tell parents this as well, do these exposure practices little and often, and if they're really showing you that they're too tired today or they don't want to, we don't push it, because as long as they are minimally safe with their nutrition, and that could be with something like supplements, we have a lot more time to do this work with the children. And we can take our time because we don't want to increase that link between food and stress. We want to make it a nice experience for them.
Understood. How has, again, how has your experience as a member of a family with a child whose gastrointestinal health is compromised enabled you to work more closely with such families?
I think it's helped me really appreciate what these parent carers have to manage every day, and especially what it's reasonable to ask a family to do. I think about some of the practices that I advise parents to do even before I had children. it makes me think back and cringe, because what the amount of work that I expected them to put in, or what you think a child can manage, for example, after a stressful and tiring day at school. It's a lot. And I think now, having that experience myself, I'm very measured about what suggestions I give to a family, or giving them backup plans if things aren't going well or the child's having a bad day.
How long can it take to bring a pre-adolescent along into a better equilibrium with her or his environment and family and eating overall?
That's a difficult question. ARFID is such a broad diagnosis. It covers lots of different reasons for not eating. So that could be, as I mentioned before, sensory avoidance, lack of interest, or fear of consequences. I think for some of these children, if they have had developmentally typical eating, and then at some point they've had a traumatic incident, such as choking on food, they can recover a lot quicker, from my experience. They tend to be quite motivated, and they have developmental skills to draw on from previous positive experiences with eating. I think the younger the child is, or the more complicating factors there are, such as medical illness or neurodivergence, then that can take a much longer time. And for some of these children, we would almost treat it as a chronic or lifelong condition that has a period of acute relapse where they might need more support, and then perhaps other times when they're doing better with their nutrition and their eating.
What kind of follow-up have you had so far? Long-term follow-up, I want to say. Or how do you transition these children to adult psychological care?
Well, this is an area that's really lacking, and it's something that we're researching further for the position paper. A lot of adult eating disorder services are not used to working with this kind of eating disorder, so it's a learning curve. And I know that certainly in the UK, provision is it's very sparse, it's very patchy. If you live in one area, you may be lucky and have a specific ARFID team for childhood and then an adult eating disorder service that can support you later on. But I'd say that's really very rare.
Mm. Thank you very much for taking the time to come and speak with us today.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you for the invitation.
But before I spring you, as it were, then would you mind adding to our Espigan podcast favorite songs list on Spotify? Have you identified a song that you'd like to put forward as special to you, maybe even special to Espigan, and or special to the class of patients or the disorder that you've come to talk to us about?
Certainly. So I have thought about this. I'm afraid it's very little to do with the topic I'm talking about today. But I grew up in England in the 90s, so I had to choose something from Britpop. So I've chosen Oasis and the song She's Electric.
She's electric. Take it away, Oasis. Thank you again.
Thank you.